Our panelists will, like the last panel, go ahead and introduce themselves, and there'll be brief presentations by the panelists, some with PowerPoint, some with Keynote, and some with hands. And so without further ado, I'll let them introduce themselves and talk.
Go ahead. My name is Russell Williams. You should just come up over here. Oh, okay. My name is Russell Williams. I'm the architect for Photoshop, and I've been working on it for about 16 years. And these are some information about a couple of things that I work with. One is the Photoshop code base, and that's some of the information about the size and the platforms and the technologies it uses. And the other is the ImageCore code base. The ImageCore is a library that's heavily used at Adobe. It's the library that implements the raw Camera Raw conversion plugin. It's also the engine behind the Lightroom application. Lightroom is basically a Lua script UI around this library. And it's also used to provide some cloud services and in the Revel tablet application. So I use this slide a lot. It's, you know, it's only approximately true, but for sort of this fall's Haswell chips, this shows sort of the distribution of where the floating point computing power is and the tools or environments or languages we would need to use to take account of them. And I couldn't quite bring myself to include the 2x factor that using floating multiply accumulate gives you, but it's still roughly true. And that little red sliver at the end, of course, is where 99-point-something% of all our code is written in C, except the stuff that's written in various scripting languages, which uses a half to a tenth of that red sliver. This table illustrates the scope of the problem we have because of the fact that we're cross-platform. See, this one is for Photoshop, and it shows platforms are the columns, and technologies, parallelization technologies, are the rows. And even though we're only on two platforms for Photoshop, the selection of technologies and those intersections drive a lot of our decisions. When we want to make something else parallel in some new way, we have a lot of issues to deal with.
That's a good idea.
By contrast, ImageCore is on a lot of platforms, but they only use a few technologies on each one, and that mostly on Android should just be another red CPU. And so the more rows you have in one of these things in your technology matrix, the harder it is to add columns, and the more columns you have, the harder it is to add rows. And each row represents a fairly complicated technology that some engineer or set of engineers has to spend a lot of time learning. And each intersection, each square that's filled in there represents usually a different set of tools that we have to use, update, learn, et cetera. So how do we deal with that? We ignore proprietary technologies whenever possible. We go for the lowest common denominator when we have to. And if sometimes there'll be a particular platform or product technology target that justifies making a big investment in some specific technology, but often we will go for something like when ImageCore was ported to ARM processors, they wrote a set of macros that turned SSE intrinsics into neon instructions. And that worked actually very well, and they got very good performance out of it. But of course, they're only using the overlap of the SSE and neon functionality, and AVX is dead in the water. They're never going to use that because there's no equivalent in neon, AVX being the double-length version of SSE. Traditionally, we've written a reference C implementation of critical algorithms, and then a hand-vectorized version, and then a GPU version. And we simply can't sustain that going into the future. So what I sort of see us doing is basically giving up on the vector version and using tools to generate the vector version from one of the other two It also helps that the tools are getting better, both vectorizing C compilers, and OpenCL generates pretty good vector code these days, CPU vector code. What we've been working on in the last year, we get these very prosaic problems. Every library that somebody gives us, they get religion about parallelism, so they create their own thread pool to handle parallelism, and we get libraries that do things like color correction sitting there with a custom thread pool. And last year at this time, I think we had 6 or 7 separate thread pools in Photoshop sitting around waiting for work. And we've been trying to get all those people to either give us wrappers or directly use TBB or directly use the platform thread pool. The UI push, the UI shift over time toward more asynchronous UIs and less pop a dialog box, fill in some values, click OK, go run over a big data set, means that we're doing more functional threading. And functional threading has the problem compared to sort of parallel computation that parallel computation tends to be pretty constrained. You get you're going to run some algorithm in parallel and it only touches the data that is being processed at that moment. Whereas with functional parallelism, like saving a document in the background while the user continues to work on it, then you get into all of the stuff that some of the previous speakers were talking about, where you have bugs in locks on your document data structures and so on. And so the overall message is that we are, while we try to be ahead of the curve and take the latest imaging research and implement that, when it comes to parallelism and tools, we cannot afford to be on the leading edge, like with OpenCL and TBB, which are in industry, they're just starting to ramp up. A lot of people aren't using them at all, as you saw from the numbers somebody had in the previous slide about how many people have those skills. We're just starting to get those things more widely deployed. Implementing on top of the latest tools is simply not an option for us because of the cross-platform issue. So those are some of the key things for us is staying behind the curve on tools and ahead of the curve on imaging.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Matsakis and I'm here from Mozilla Research, but I'm guessing a lot of you know that Mozilla makes the Firefox web browser, but you may not know that we also do research, and we have been for a little while now, and we mostly focus on kind of lower level, platform level things that we can use in the future, or at least my group. So what I wanted, I think I organized this talk wrong, so I'm gonna skip all the way to the end and start from there instead. I was thinking about what does it mean to be in academia versus practice, and basically in my experience going from PhD into industrial research, there are a couple of things that seem pretty different with regard to the projects we work on, and those are what I listed there. And of course they're all completely wrong, as you guys can tell me later, but there are also, I think, some truth, which is that when you're working in the industrial research setting, there's this large body of legacy code, like I don't even know how many million lines of code Firefox is, but it's a lot. And you have to work with it, and you're trying usually to improve that. And that's a pretty hard constraint. And you don't get to throw things out quite as much as you do in academia. You don't get to say, boy, it would be nice if HTML didn't have floats. Let's just do layout algorithms without them. And you know, everything works a lot nicer that way, but that often avoids some of the hard problems as well, right? And you have to really work on rounding out your implementation. So that's why I said here, the implementation trumps publishing. So I haven't written, I wrote one paper on some of the work I've been doing on Rust, but it was already out of date by the time I finished it, and now I'm still just working on the implementation because I want to get that all finished and getting that in use, and then we can worry about publishing some of the ideas, right? And the transitioning to engineering is something that's sort of a uniquely industrial research problem, I think, although maybe with startups in academia that's not true. But trying to take some research that you've been doing and get it out there, and hopefully not with you maintaining it, is kind of an interesting problem that I'm not really sure how to solve yet. But maybe some people can give me advice on that. But this, I thought I'd then just go look at some of the projects we do and see how does that apply. So one of the ones that I'm heavily involved in is the Rust programming language and the Servo project, which uses it. So Servo is kind of a re-architected browser engine. And it's built in this language called Rust, which is essentially a re-architected C++. And the goal is to kind of make something that you can use for low latency applications like browsers, but also it turns out games are very interested in this, and a couple other things where you really only have a choice of C++ today. And give you something that has a higher level of abstraction but still offers the same low level performance. This seems like a total greenfield project in some regards. I mean, you have a new programming language, a new engine, but we still have to work with the same old web with JavaScript, with an engine, you know, with a model that was kind of designed for single-threaded execution. I mean, you can do things like emit from your JavaScript bytes that inject into your parser stream because it just seemed like a natural idea, right? That why would you be parsing in parallel with executing your scripts? I don't know. Anyhow, so that there's still a lot of legacy constraints to worry about there. And the implementation issues are, writing a full language compiler is a lot harder than writing a research one, it turns out. It's not enough to just throw an exception when anything doesn't parse. You have to like tell people why. It's really a pain. So the other project I work on personally is this parallel JavaScript, where we're trying to extend the language with parallel constructs. Like, this is actually a collaboration with Intel. So they worked on a River Trail prototype. I think there was even a talk here last year on it. But you can have things like map par that will map across an array in parallel and so forth. And here, I think one of the biggest challenges is working with the standardization process and getting these ideas, you know, accepted and getting them implemented in many number of browsers. So it's not enough to just build a good technology. You also really got to sell it and also transition it. That's the other. This is a place where transition is very important. So there's ASM.js and Inscripten, which is targeting taking C++ code and running it in JavaScript. And I think if there's any better example of dealing with legacy code, I don't know what it is. Here we have, you know, C++ code bases, and we have this language JavaScript that's very widely distributed, but not really intended for this purpose. And it turns out they can be put together pretty well. Some of you may have heard of ASM.js, I guess, but it's basically a subset of JavaScript that can be statically typed and which can be used to compile C++ code. And if you optimize for that and you get to throw away all your heuristics and all your other things, then you can get pretty good performance. So this chart shows the green line there that's basically about twice as high as the yellow line. The yellow line is the native performance. The green line is this optimized one. And the other lines are standard JIT compilers. So you see it makes a big difference. And then we have things like Shumway, which is a project to build a virtual machine in JavaScript, normal JavaScript, that can be executed by any browser for Flash. So that's another case of, well, we have this really widely used execution language. Let's see what else we can do with it and how far we can push it. And finally, we have the Firefox operating system that's now actually fully transitioned into a product, but it began as a research project with the goal of, can we make a phone operating system that is like iPhone, competitive with Android, but is just a web browser, where everything is a page. You don't have an app and a page distinction, app and a web page. And this will be available in some markets soon, maybe now, I don't really know. But it's very nice. So yeah, now I'm back to my last slide. So I think you've seen that these themes kind of come through. And I guess that's about it. Thanks very much.
So I guess I'll just leave this up since I don't have any slides. So I'm Martin Reinert. I'm a professor, have been since 1994. I've been working in the field of parallel computing since the mid-80s. And when I saw the title of this panel, my first reaction was, you know, I don't view this as practitioners versus academics. I view this as practitioners with academics. And that's been, throughout most of the history of the field, there's been a fairly close relationship between practitioners and academics. And there's a very good reason for that technically. And here's the reason. It turns out that in parallel computing, unlike, to some extent, the rest of computing, what you can and can't do is very closely tied to the characteristics of the computation that you're working with. And therefore, if you're doing parallel computing and you want to be relevant, you need to understand the characteristics of the computation, and you've got to go out and find realistic computations that you care to address. Notice that this doesn't mean that your tool needs to address all parallel computations. There's a range of parallel computations, and it's perfectly acceptable for your tool to hit only part of that range. But it's also true that doing parallel computing in complete isolation from applications tends to be a rather sterile result, and here's why. There's a tragedy in parallel computing, okay? The tragedy is that if you're looking to do intellectually interesting things, you want applications where you have to do something intellectually interesting to be successful. Now, in parallel computing, it turns out, to a first approximation, there are some exceptions, but to a first approximation, there are two kinds of applications. Applications where it is so hard to do anything that you can never be successful. The other kind of applications are where it's so easy to make them parallel that there's nothing interesting to do. So this is the tragedy of parallel computing, because what you really want is something in the middle, where you have to be smart, and there's room for you to be smart and do interesting things, and unless you do that, you can't succeed. The only caveat I put to that is if you're worried about data movement. Sometimes you can do smart things with data movement, but even there, the most successful parallel computations have always been, I get this huge pile of data, I want to do something roughly similar to all the elements in the data, and then maybe combine some results, and if I can do that, I'm successful. If I can't, chances are, I can't be successful. Now, another reason that parallel computing over the course has been, there's been a close collaboration between academics and practitioners is, in a lot of cases, the practitioners have been academics. Because scientific computing for a long time drove the field, and a lot of scientific computing people are either academics or very closely related to academics. Now, I think the change is, and there's a change coming, because that change has been triggered by the quote-unquote big data phenomenon. Okay, so right now, it is to the advantage of a lot of companies to go off and do parallel computations on large chunks of at least confidential, in many cases classified, data. And what that's going to do is it's going to make it more difficult for the academics and practitioners to get together so the academics understand the kind of problems the practitioners are facing. Okay, so it's going to drive that apart. A partial counterbalancing force is the fact that is the whole open source movement, where even if I'm doing confidential or even classified computations on confidential or even classified data, I'm still doing it, in many cases, with open source. So you can get an idea of how that might work. So I think moving forward, we're going to see a challenge here in keeping the academics and the practitioners close enough together to make it worthwhile to do good, to make it easy to do good parallel computing research in academia. And the risk for academics is the relevance and focus is going to shift away. So it's going to be difficult to do relevant, it's going to be more difficult to do relevant research in academia. And finally, I'd like to say that to understand this issue, you need to understand the role of the two parties, okay? The role of the practitioners is to build a system and get a result out there that satisfies some need, okay? The role of the academics is to produce ideas, concepts, and people, not software systems. Okay? So as long as you have, not production software systems, okay? In some cases, you have to do prototype software systems. So as long as people understand those two roles and can satisfy the relationships productively in the way they approach their work, I think everything's going to be fine. So that's it.
Okay, we're going to open up to questions from the audience.
So I have a question, kind of everyone. The implementation bullet point, I like that you left this slide up, by the way, it's really convenient. The implementation bullet point, I think it's for the most part true based on my experience, what you said and what Martin just said, that academics don't often take things through the last mile, and so academics focus more on the ideas, and there's a lot of engineering that's beyond just getting the ideas there and getting a prototype. So what I'm wondering is if there are any kind of anecdotes or insight, like very clear insights that you got from doing that last mile that academics might be oblivious to because they don't often take, a project through to that last you know, the last mile of development. Maybe this is a question for the practitioners, but I guess it's relevant to everyone. So. Yeah.
I'll answer first, I guess. I would say yes, definitely. Certainly in the design of Rust, for example, we've gone through a lot of iterations in some key parts, like the memory safety type system. And a lot of those changes were just triggered by us building the Rust compiler in Rust, and after a while being like, you know what, this is okay. It's theoretically workable, but it's kind of annoying. And maybe we can do it better. And I think if we had to build 100,000 lines of code to realize some of those problems and to see them emerge. And I think I think we're going to see even more once we start building, you know, so building Servo also helped, because that's like, you know, the tools you need to write a compiler are not the tools you need to write every program in the world, it turns out. Though that's too bad, but so just building a diversity of things with it helped expose ways that it should, was more, things that were awkward and things that were not.
Just my theme for this one is that the last mile for us is cross-platform. And often the transition is complete for many people when an academic, a new language or something is implemented on Linux and there's a solid version of it. But that's not sufficient for us. And the other part of the last mile is maintenance and support going forward. Because if a tool or a language gets discontinued on one or two platforms after a couple of years because not enough people are interested in it, then we're in a really bad place.
Okay, so I'm on the other side of this divide. And in general, I have aspired in my career to be very far out of where people are going, not necessarily from the systems I work with, but from the concepts that I'm working with. So I have generally tried to stay away from the large implementation efforts that where these issues that these guys are talking about arise. Because the way I look at it, I have a set of resources, and one of which is time and implementation ability, and a set of ideas that I want to explore. And I'm always having to make a trade-off is the amount of resources I have to invest to explore this idea worth the potential trade-off, worth the potential benefit I think I'm going to get. And in my career, I have tended to go towards projects that maximize my ability to explore a concept while minimizing the amount of implementation that I have to do to get there. Okay? Now, having said that, whenever you do anything, you have to decide what problem am I solving. Okay? So if it turns out that there are problems, interesting problems that happen to appear when you get, you know, close to the completion of a project or even 10 years into the maintenance of a project, and I think there's a way that I can, with reasonable effort, attack that problem, I'm perfectly happy to do so. But for me, it's all a resources versus payoff. And I think the payoff I'm looking for is different from the payoff that a lot of practitioners are looking for. And therefore, that changes the trade-off that I'm looking at. And I think there's one thing is for sure, right? Both activities are legitimate, but if you want to be successful, you have to know what your goal is. You can't get caught up if you're an academic saying, well, you know, I want to go off and compete with these practitioner guys and, you know, build some open source piece of software that everybody's going to use. If you're doing that, you're in the wrong place in my view in academia. Okay. On the other hand, if you are a practitioner whose goal is to go out there and build products that are going to be widely used around the world, which is a legitimate goal for these guys, you got to be careful about how much innovation you want to inflict upon your users. Okay. So, again, the most important thing is knowing what your goals are and aligning your activities to maximize your chance of success of realizing your goal.
Right. I tend to review some academic proposals and research grants every now and then. And most exciting are the ones that make some kind of unrealistic assumption as part of the problem statement and then look at the consequences of what happens if that assumption is true, because someday maybe that assumption will be true and then all of a sudden you have a full fleshed out solution to that particular problem. Have you seen similar types of behavior, and what types of unrealistic assumptions are actually most valuable, if you could explore that a little bit?
I mean, how about if I take a stab at it? I mean, I think that's a fabulous question, and I would like to think about it a little bit more, but I'm perfectly happy to take a stab at it while these guys are thinking about it, okay? So, to make a big change in the world, so if you look at the world the way it is right now, okay? The way the world is right now, at the end of the day, makes a lot of sense for the conditions in which the world finds itself. So if you're looking to build, there's a reason that all the systems look the way they are. So as you point out, and I think I agree, to make a big difference, a transformative difference, something has to change. Okay? What can change? Well, the technological conditions can change. And that's been pervasive throughout the field of computer science and has driven much of the development. So I think a great example of this is, and an example that is not fully appreciated is the data flow research back in the 70s and 80s is a perfect example of a kind of research where what they were trying to do was completely unrealistic in the architecture framework of the 70s and 80s. But if you look at all machines today, they are, in effect, data flow machines that share a lot of conceptual similarities with the kind of machines people were exploring back in the 70s and 80s. So most people don't realize that, right? At the end of the day, risk was a failure and data flow won. But that's not the way the story comes out. So I think the assumptions that these guys were making in the 70s and 80s when they were doing data flow, as you point out, were unrealistic assumptions, but assumptions that eventually came to be true in the field. That's a great example of that kind of research. So one is technological change. Another is the value system in the field. What do you want out of a computation? So if you're built, it used to be that the field was founded on hard logical correctness computations, compilers, databases, where you sort of isolate the world inside the computer, know exactly what it's going to do, and you know it's either correct or not. And if it's incorrect, it's just wrong. Now we're moving into an environment where, you get noisy data, people want stuff fast, it's not really clear what's correct and what isn't. A lot of people are there for the experience, and if you give them a good experience, they couldn't care less what the specification is. So if you change the assumption that the program has to be correct, what you can do is perhaps get out into a world where after the technological change happens and the sociological change happens, you do something that's relevant and turns out to be relevant later. There's another thing, and that is if you change the assumptions and show that you're in a good place, you can change the way that people approach the world. So it doesn't necessarily have to be some sort of objective change in the situation. It can be a change in people's brains about what they expect and what they want out of a computer system. So there's a systematic way to do this. What you can do is you can write down the assumptions in your field. Okay, this is a way to automate the generation of research ideas. Okay? What you do is you write down all the assumptions of your field. And you get a context of the field. The context is a logical conjunction of all the assumptions that you've made. Okay? You now have available to you, let's say you have n assumptions that you've articulated. You now have available to you 2 to the n different research agendas. Because all you have to do is start negating all of these assumptions. Okay? So you can generate as much research as you want. What this does is it puts you out, and each set of assumptions either gets you to a fantasy world that may never exist, a fantasy world that may exist with time because the technology changes, or a fantasy world that may exist with time because people's attitudes towards computers and what they want out of them can change. So I am indefinitely in favor of this approach. I think it's fabulous, and I think the field needs to understand it, because the easiest way to kill a research proposal is to say, this won't work because blah, where you quote some commonly accepted wisdom that may not be true 5 or 10 years from now. But I think it's a great question and a great observation.
One thing I would say about that is questioning those assumptions or changing those assumptions works really great for producing new, innovative products that take advantage of the change in that assumption.
changes in those kind of fundamental assumptions are more, much more problematic for old and legacy code bases because they have millions of lines of code with that assumption baked into them in some way, with zillions of assumptions baked into them in some way. And when you change one of those assumptions, you say, well, actually, all the compute power is out at the end of this PCI bus, and that's where we should be doing all of our heavy computation. It's like turning an aircraft carrier or something when you've got a 20-year-old code base with 10 million lines of code in it.
I'm wondering how specific this is to academia. Like, it seems to me that one of the things that Apple made Apple very successful recently was doing exactly what we just said, but in the product space, right? Taking assumptions away and just pushing the market towards that area. So it seems like it's a good way to drive and do innovative things, but that doesn't have to be academics who want that, I guess.
Is it my turn now? Are you done? So I classify myself, I think, as a practitioner in a research environment. And so I'm curious about your ideas on one of the most frustrating kind of talks that I go to is one where an academic person has created a great idea and a reference implementation, and at the end of the talk you ask, great, is this going to be released? And they say, oh, actually, no, I'm going to be finishing school and I'm not going to carry this product forward. Do you have any thoughts on what can be done to help that sort of a situation where there's something that's a great idea but is being dropped because the academic person that came up with it isn't carrying it along any further?
You could pay them.
Heresy.
That probably is the right answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think open source helps a lot with that, but I know that is a very frustrating thing, and I don't know what can be done, really, but yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm not necessarily seeing this as a bad situation. You know, the idea is out there; it dumps itself into the subconsciousness of the field, rattles around. You know, at some point, somebody may take it up or may not take it up. You can have the reproductive strategy of a human being, where you have very few children and nurture them. Or you can have the reproductive strategy of a rat, where you have a bazillion kids, and you know maybe some of them survive, maybe some of them don't. And you know, in the aggregate, so for an individual, I think you as an academic have to view yourself as producing research ideas with the human strategy. You got to pay attention to your idea, make every idea as good as you can while you're working on it. But society should view academia as something where you pursue the rat research, the rat reproductive strategy, where you have 10 bazillion ideas going on at the same time, very few of which are going to have an immediate impact on society. But you can expect those very few ideas to have an enormously large impact on society. So I don't necessarily view dropping a good idea as a bad thing.
I will mention one other strategy, which is leave it on the doorstep of the hospital. We get a fair number of features that get implemented by a researcher who has a fabulous idea, and they know a lot about some particular area of they've advanced the field in some area of image processing, and maybe they also know a lot about C++ templates and vectorized code, and they write this really amazing implementation of a cutting-edge image processing algorithm that's templatized out the wazoo or threaded with TBB out the wazoo or something like that, and then they go on to their next job. And that particular combination of technologies becomes another little box in this humongous grid. And 6 months later, there's a bug. Or somebody, the next version of TBB comes along and it's not compatible in some way. And then somebody has to go in there and figure all that out.
That was my last comment I wanted to say was, you may not actually want to see that source code that they're talking about. There's probably a reason that they don't want to release it. But we'll see.
I mean, to tell you the truth, I've had students who've purposely made their system difficult to install so they wouldn't have to deal with it.
So, So this isn't a question, it's just a comment. So Matt Might has this very, very funny, he's a professor at Utah. He has a very funny license that you can attach to your software that he encourages all academics to adopt. It's called the crapware license. And it's essentially, it's, here's my code, sorry.
Yeah. So a question regarding the enormous grid, compatibility grid. So is this grid problem going to go away as soon as you push everybody into your Creative Cloud? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I don't actually...
And you get to control your own servers, in other words, right?
Right. You know, they've called it the Creative Cloud, but really all of that software is still running on the desktops and laptops, and there's no good solution for the level of interactivity that you want with a device or your desktop or laptop machine that involves actually running some highly interactive piece of software in the cloud.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking if you see that changing in the longer term. And I mean, sure, this is true now, but you know, is Adobe in 10 years going to have a slice of a little cloudlet in, you know, co-hosted in every ISP, around the world, just like Akamai, you know, everywhere Akamai is, Adobe is as well, and you've got your little, you know, interactive cloudlets close to every, you know, or, I mean, is that, you know, what you're moving toward, or is this completely bogus?
Well, I don't think anybody is thinking that far ahead about where we're headed, but I do think that there is a point there, and that more things will be implemented only in the cloud, and to the extent that you have things that you can do just in the cloud, then you get rid of all those other columns and you just have Linux, right? That helps a lot.
Almost got taken out. So I'm gonna go back to this question of grad student code. So it seems to me that there are potentially three categories we might place code in. There's what I call grad student code as opposed to the Utah license. There's production code. And then there's what I would call a useful prototype, which is better than what I call grad student code. And I guess I'm really curious what your thoughts are on, actually from everybody on the panel. So what should we expect of our more systems-y oriented grad students, right? Should we let them out with grad student code, or should we want useful prototype code? And does it matter when you look at hiring people? You know, where do you draw the line on what's acceptable for your students to produce? So this has nothing really to do with parallelism per se, but it's sort of this problem of grad student code. Go for it.
Well, we have deal with this a fair amount. We don't deal with grad student code so much, but we have researchers often who produce useful prototypes, and they work with production engineers to re-implement that in production code. And so for new research, we generally do a MATLAB implementation of a useful prototype or a C++ straightforward implementation of a useful prototype that doesn't handle image tiling, for instance, and then we redo it as production code.
I'm of the opinion that it's too much work to expect a grad student to produce a really well-rounded implementation most of the time. I mean, maybe if you have a team, or if there, it depends a lot on the project, but I think it will hinder their ability to do advanced things in the end, because it's a trade-off of time and energy, and exactly what Martin said earlier. And you want to keep that trade-off as far towards ideas as you can.
So for a slightly different perspective on this issue, my father worked in the biological sciences. And there, the only thing they care about is the result at the end of the day. And it's their responsibility to do the most efficient experiment they can to get that result. So my perspective is that what I'm looking for my graduate students at the end of the day is a result, and I expect them to get that result with the least effort possible. Now, in some cases, you may need, so of course, the quality of the code that you build is determined then by the result that you want. And you can imagine situations in which you need a fairly high production quality code. For example, if your result depends on hundreds of people using your software, you have to engineer that software so that hundreds of people can use it. Okay? I have tended to stay away from projects like that because for me, the intellectual payoff that you get from these kind of projects isn't worth the amount of time, energy, and engineering resources it takes to do them. Now, having said that, I also have, so I'm personalizing this because that's the only way I know how to answer the question. I also have a sort of an engineering team now that goes off and services these big DARPA contracts. There, that's a very different situation. If you're hiring people to get specific results, again, you're going to get the piece of software engineered to the quality that you need. So I think, again, the big determining factor is what result do I want, what idea do I need, and how do I get that with the least amount of implementation effort. And what that means is that you will often get systems that are quote-unquote graduate student quality or worse, and that's perfectly acceptable. And a horrible, horrible, horrible piece of code that gets you a result in, say, 6 months beats the heck out of a gorgeous piece of code that gets you the same result in 2 years. And that goes true for practitioners, academics, everybody.
I think all of us that have been around as long as I have seen a rather wide range of quality from both practitioners and researchers. And so I think in both cases, it kind of depends on what the requirements and skills are involved. Yeah. I just wanted to actually take Martin up on his thing on being on the same side. I want to thank you, Martin, for presenting some ideas that are apparently crazy enough that they are even crazier than the things I do as a day-to-day life. So thank you.
You're very welcome, and I hope to do even crazier things in the future.
We'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
Back a little bit on this systems thing. Margo got up here, and Margo obviously a systems builder, and I think had stellar contributions in that area. And I don't think that you can have the same kind of impact on the field necessarily by saying here's an idea, right? It really sometimes the proof really is in the pudding, right? You have to get it out there, and you have to see it really works. And saying, well, I've got some great idea. I'll give you an example of just a random one. I'll make up. Suppose I say I've got a race detector.
A what?
A race detector.
Okay.
Okay? I'm just coming up with an example. And the whole point of the race detector is to be super, super fast. So this is this thing that in the previous panel, Tip Mosley said was a solved problem, except for being fast enough to run in production. Mm-hmm. Right? So then I come up with something, and I put together some half-assed thing, and it appears to work, and I run it on whatever minimum requisite number of benchmarks that let me get it past the program committee, and I say, done, and I put my stake in the ground. But the result is probably false. That is to say that I claim that I have some sort of result, but if you actually dig deeper, it's not going to be true. It's not going to turn out to have been a real result. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I assume we're not talking about falsifying data here?
No, not deliberately falsifying data, just getting something out. I've definitely seen situations where people, especially as the deadline draws nearer and the hour gets later, that people are willing to cut corners, say, it works now, like it crashed 2 seconds ago, but now it seems to have run. Right? Not my students, but...
Oh, never, never, never.
Right. Actually, I've threatened to pull papers when shenanigans like that start to occur. But in any event, there's a lot of deadline pressure in our field, right?
Sure.
The goal of researchers, like you said, is to get these ideas out there, but in principle, but in practice, the goal is actually to get papers out there, right? And so cutting corners is maybe a way to get ideas out there, but it's primarily used, I think, as a way of getting papers out there. And the results, the actual ideas or the science, may be compromised.
So, okay, so I can talk about this for quite some time, and I'll talk about it for a little time. First of all, I try, and I think most good academics, try not to run their research program just to produce papers. Having said that, you have to have papers. It's a fact of life. If you don't have papers, you can't do the rest. Okay? So the way I look at it is, you know, papers are a necessary evil that you, I mean, okay, not, okay, papers themselves aren't, but getting papers accepted at conferences is a necessary evil, and you have to play that game. And you've got to balance that game off with the rest of the game that you're playing. Okay? So, again, my bias is towards, because, you know, if I look back on the papers that I think are really important in the field, they're all important because of the ideas. There are some papers that are important because of the numbers, but very, but relatively few. So I am, and I think that if you start requiring impeccably executed experimental results to take away all possible doubt about what's going on, you make some results better. You take away some of these, you know, spurious things where you just happen to hit the right combination in the machine that day, got lucky, and you're publishing your results, and it's sort of a narrow anomaly that you're publishing instead of a result. I think you can take some of those papers away. What I think you also do is you bias the entire evaluation process of the field in a way that increases the bar for publication in a way that's counterproductive for most of the important papers in the field. Okay? I don't think there's anything wrong with the way most of the people, most of the field does evaluation right now, except that the conferences are, again, becoming too biased towards getting the kind of experimental results that you're looking for. So I'm against that trend in the field, even though I acknowledge the benefits that it may bring to certain areas of the field. Okay? And I think reasonable people can differ on this topic.
I don't exactly differ, but I was thinking about what I said earlier about were there problems that only came up after I'd done a lot of implementation, and I think the answer is definitely yes in a lot of them. And contrasting that with my statement that it's too much to expect people to do the implementation all the way when they're grad students. And I was thinking, maybe part of the problem, I think that they're both statements are true, but maybe we just need to find ways to reward the furthering of projects and the rounding out of results. I don't know, and ways to build on prior results that are more effective. Because I think that's a lot of the problem, is a lot of people tend to start from scratch with a new idea, and sometimes it's valuable to push an idea forward a little further, even after, I don't know, even after the primary publication is done.
I would say there's two different effects that happen there. One, for infrastructure things, for the kind of things this conference is about, parallelism, that stuff doesn't even matter to us because it has to get so far beyond that point before we will look at it as a tool to use in our implementation that's lost in the noise. For the stuff that is problem-oriented for us, imaging research, what that turns into is maybe we implement it and we throw it away when we spend some money trying to productize it and we discover that it isn't actually as solid as the paper led us to believe. Or sometimes we actually get to a product and we end up with something that we hoped would be revolutionary and it's only 20% better and we've just added to the clutter and stuff in our application.
So yeah, actually I want to get to stay on the same topic. I mean, this seems essentially, it's a modeling error. You have a model of this phenomenon you're trying to study, you hope the model is accurate, it's not missing too many key phenomena, and if you have like a grad student forgetting to put synchronization into a program, that's why it crashes, that's a really bad modeling error because you're not taking the performance hit of the synchronization, but nobody notices this. So this is something we do not do as a community, which is a shame, to say, here's my model, here's the kinds of errors that my model has compared to the reality, my best guess, obviously, and you know, your mileage will vary depending on how far away my model is to your reality. We don't have it, it seems like we should. I'm not sure how to standardize it, but it seems really valuable. And I don't know if you, well, anybody has an idea.
I mean, I will say that, for example, the software engineering community, you always have to have a section in your paper called threats to what?
Threats to validity.
Well, I mean, it sounds great in practice. I mean, it sounds great in theory. What happens in practice is, you know, there's a couple of standard things. It's sort of like a magic incantation you quote there. And you know, I think it's less than compelling. I mean, I have never found a compelling threats to validity section in any paper, either that I've read or written. And I think it's turned into a, you know, just another little box to check off. And the combination of requiring that kind of threats to validity paper and page limits means that you have less time to devote to what's really, less space to devote to what's really important in the paper. So having said that, I do think it's important to help the reader understand where it's valid and where it isn't. And, you know, when we write our papers, we try to do that throughout the course of the paper. But, you know, hey, life is, you know, it's look, research is like raking sausage. And, you know, nothing's perfect in this world. At the end of the day, if you expect perfection, you raise the bar too high, and it's counterproductive.
So you're right, obviously.
Yeah.
And it is a competitive pressure to say, I don't feel like saying too much bad stuff about myself, because then the program committee would realize that I haven't done my paper. But what it should be is, here are the limits, and I'm glad I know what your limits are, so be me as a PC member, and I know kind of which box to put you like. I work with resilience. A ton of things we over-approximate. Mm-hmm. And I wish, well, I had been, you know, disciplined to do this, actually list out all the things that I don't account for. But one, it's too much effort, and two, I'll look bad for the junk paper.
No, I think the reviewing process is a huge problem in our field, and I don't know how to get around effects like you're talking about. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, I tell you what I do. I just keep submitting the paper. You know, eventually it gets in. Okay? But there is, you know, there is a danger here, right? Because if you read some of the proposals for people about how they're going to change the reviewing process, there's an implicit assumption that the reviewer is right and the person writing the paper is wrong. In my experience, this is essentially never true. Because the person writing the paper spent, you know, a minimum of 4 to 6 weeks on it, some of that time thinking deeply about the idea. The reviewer typically spent 20 to 40 minutes, most of the time not thinking at all. So any system that assumes the reviewer is even remotely sane is going to have problems when you go to implement it in reality. But I think the good thing about the bad thing about our field is that there's no reviewing continuity. But that's also the good thing about the field. Because, you know, anyway.
It's the escape hatch.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't have questions, really just a comment. Mm-hmm. Comment on the topic that was said, that a wild idea that doesn't necessarily get practiced soon. I'm thinking about, you know, Higgs and the Higgs boson. It was theorized in the 60s and proven this year, but how the question is, and you probably don't know the answer, when will you see some a practical result of the Higgs boson? So that's just to bend your mind a little bit.
Oh. What was the practice? Okay, so. So, you guys want to take a shot at that? Or I'm perfectly happy to. All right, so here we're talking something completely different, okay? Computer science is, at some level, an engineering field, okay? Having said that, I'm a big fan of curiosity-driven research, okay? And I'm a big fan, and I think the empirical, again, it gets down to the rat reproduction strategy that I mentioned earlier. The history has shown that, counterintuitively, if you set off a bunch, you know, if your society takes some, you know, smart, talented, capable people, and sets them off doing whatever they want, even if you cannot figure out why it's even remotely relevant, over the course of centuries, you tend to generate a lot of very useful, powerful technology. Okay?
Just like Ethernet from Alto Labs, which is just based on randomness?
I wouldn't call it randomness. I would call it based on the fact that it's just an empirical fact that you search a lot of interesting ideas, and sometimes you get hits where you didn't expect it. Okay? And so in that sense, it's productive. Now, the Higgs boson thing, that I'm not so sure about, and I'll tell you why. Basically, the guys knew it was there. Basically, they spent, you know, bazillions and bazillions of dollars building this huge thing to confirm a fact they pretty much knew already. And it's hard for me to see that as the most productive use of that money, On the other hand, the total amount of resources that science spends, that society spends on science, is a ridiculously small fraction of what it spends on all kinds of other, in my view, much less worthwhile things. And so I got no problem spending that kind of money on the Higgs boson. I just think they ought to spend more money on lots of other things.
One thing I would say real quick about the applicability of research is that generally what we find when we turn it into practice is by the time it gets to us, it's not so much that things are completely wrong, that they just lucked out on the result, but that the generality is more constrained than was claimed, and the level of improvement was somewhat less than was claimed, and the cost of actually implementing it is inevitably higher than was estimated.
So I have a comment kind of related to what that guy was saying before, that is that I agree that, you know, writing down your limitations as you see them and writing down your threats to your validity, whether people do that and it's all wind or whether they actually write down real threats, that's another thing. But I think that's an important part of a paper. But something else that I think is important is actually being able to believe the results that you're reading. So it'd be easy to write a paper with no evaluation that had a really awesome result that said, and we use teleportation as a subroutine and we have great performance. Mm-hmm. But no one should believe that result, because if there's no evaluation, then, you know, no one should believe that, because teleportation doesn't exist, and we all know that. But I guess what I'm wondering is what level of evaluation, so there's a continuum now between zero evaluation and, you know, building Photoshop, and somewhere along there, academics should choose to, like, drop a pin. And then on the other side, people reading papers need to say, like, well, that's enough evaluation for me to believe this. And part of it might be, like I said, stating limitations like you guys were just talking about. But I think there's something more than just writing down what you think is wrong. I think that another part of this is actually doing some empirical study that shows, like, this is evidence enough that we expect it to generalize in a useful way or something like that. This was a comment. This was not as much of a question, but it's more of a...
No, but I think it's a great comment. I think it's great observation. And I do have something to say about it. And that is, I think the evaluation you do depends a lot on the research that you're doing. For example, if I say, I've got this great idea about this kind of system, and you look at the idea, you look at what they're trying to do, and it's plausible that if you build the system, it would work, and it would work that way, I like to see some prototype there where it just sort of confirms that they built it, thought through the ideas, and there's no, you know, surprises waiting for you in the initial sort of implementation period.
But isn't the plausibility wrapped up in some empirical study that shows that it actually is, in fact, plausible? Your perception of plausibility might be misaligned with what the reality of the data would show.
That, for me, that depends very heavily on the project. For example, if I say, you know, I bet we can make web browsing for our department faster if we cache all the web pages in some central place and then go there. Sounds pretty plausible. The guy does it, has some numbers that show it might work. It's good enough for me. Okay? If, on the other hand, the guy says, you know, if you have a counterintuitive result, like if you say, it turns out that if you remove the instruction cache, the machine runs faster. There, I would like to see a bit more evidence that it's true, or at least true in some circumstances. So in my field, programming languages, or one of my subfields, programming languages, you've got the end that's most like natural sciences, which is garbage collection. Okay, garbage collection is this big mysterious thing that nobody really understands. All you want out of it is performance. So there, you tend to see there's more valuable to go in, do a thorough implementation, a very thorough evaluation. And it's no surprise that the pressure in the field to have more thorough evaluations is coming from people who have done a lot of garbage collection research, because it's valuable in that context. Now, you have over here program verification research. There, it's very plausible that at some level you can prove that if you have a program that has some property, that you can prove that it has that property. Okay? So therefore, I'm much more willing to... And the only question there is, you know, how do you make it work? What are the valuable things? In that kind of area, I'm much less interested in having wholesale empirical evaluations. I'm much more interested in seeing new, creative, and interesting ideas.
And a proof that those things are believable. I assume, because if I wrote down some crazy idea and I had neither a proof nor an evaluation, you have no reason to believe me.
No, no, but it depends to me. If the idea is really crazy and really intriguing, then I think it is potentially very worthwhile to encourage that person to pursue. Okay, so, you know,
I'm going to write a paper on teleportation then.
No, okay, let me make a comment on that, okay?
Yeah.
If the paper is written as in the following way, let's assume that we have teleportation. If we do, then the following interesting and intriguing thing is possible. That's the kind of paper that I'm willing to consider. If the paper says, we want to go from point A to point B really quickly, and guess what, we're going to use teleportation, that's not the kind of paper that I'm willing to consider, right? Because if you're going to make a counterfactual assumption, I want to see some interesting scenario come out of that counterfactual assumption before I value it heavily.
I just think it's kind of interesting that if you say that when you have a counterintuitive result, you need to have more evaluation, which makes total sense, but it definitely puts more of a burden than on if you want to do something advanced, you have to implement more, right, or evaluate more, which is kind of interesting, I think.
I think the way you—that's a great point, and it's something I've suffered tremendously from in my career. And I think the way that you deal with that is you understand the scope in which is you accept relatively limited scopes in which the content. Okay, so if you guys are ever on a program committee, never do this. Okay. Some guy has an optimization. He says, this optimization is targeted for the 30% of programs that have this property. Okay, we're now running it on this benchmark set. We've chosen the 30% of the programs that have this property out of the benchmark set, and it works great on those. We didn't run it on the worst, on the rest, because we don't expect it to do good there, because it won't. Mm-hmm. Review comes back. You should run it on the whole program committee, on the whole benchmark set. Okay, never do this. It is stupid, counterproductive, and destructive.
Yeah, so I've long said that you'll appreciate this comment, that if you have a program optimization and the optimization does nothing for anything except for Photoshop, that's actually really important, right? That's actually really good, right? Hey, you made Photoshop run 25% faster. It doesn't work for anything else. That you didn't run spec. It has no effect. It's fine. All right, so I wanted to bring this, we need to bring this to a close because lunch, but I wanted to also bring this back to parallelism. So Martin made this comment that he thinks that parallelism is, as a field, because of accessing confidential data, things like this, it's going to push practitioners and academics further apart. I'd like to hear from the practitioners what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think it means that the work on modeling, basically the work on, let me put it this way, a lot of the work that I've read in parallel things is quite inaccessible. I mean, there's a lot of parallel research requires very detailed modifications to the code, and the areas in which we find accessible parallel models is relatively limited, but it's also extremely difficult, as far as I can tell. I mean, it seems like it's just very hard to get that to actually perform. To find a model is not necessarily so hard, but to actually bridge the gap between the practice and the theory is quite difficult. And it actually also connects back to what we were just saying, because it's hard even to evaluate parallel models in the abstract. You sort of want to see how well you can make them perform, and yet that also is a big burden then also. And it's hard sometimes with like a type system or something like that to evaluate it any other way but looking at how you can express different programs. But nonetheless, I guess the conclusion is I think it's a good opportunity now, because this is going to be very important. Being able to make parallelism very accessible also to non-academics and non-experts. So.
Yeah, I think there is a huge gap. I'm not sure that the secrecy of big data sets particularly affects us that much, but it's definitely a long way from looking at a theoretical model or advance in how to parallelize things to getting something that we're willing to start implementing against. And I don't see that getting particularly, it's such a long distance right now. I can't tell if it's getting longer or shorter. It's sort of over the horizon. I come here and I see really interesting ideas, and occasionally we get, like there was a paper last year at SIGGRAPH, I think, on a language called Halide, that was a really interesting approach to separating out addressing the problem that the keynote speaker addressed earlier, where you separate out the expression of the algorithm from the mapping of it to the parallel resources in the memory hierarchy, instead of encoding it in this very interleaved way, the way that OpenCL and things like that do. And they were, they had some really exciting research results, and they now have an open source implementation, but it is still such a long way from being implemented in a cross-platform way and validated and having a tool set that we can depend on, that it's gonna be a while. And by the time it gets to the point where we would consider using it, I would expect it to be really solidly established as to the benefits of it.
I think these guys know better than I do what the jump is. So, you know, I mean, I stand by my position, I guess, which is that, you know, as big data and parallel computing becomes increasingly pervasive across large portions of industry, that's going to increase the distance. What it does is it makes it more difficult for you sitting in academia to know precisely what problems people are having to tackle in industry. And that makes it harder for you to do research that you expect to be relevant to people.
I mean, we actually made the mistake of jumping on the bandwagon for something a little bit too early with this thing called Pixel Bender that was developed inside Adobe, that was an attempt to do something higher level and more cross-platform. And the problem was that while it addressed the issues it tried to address, we didn't have the critical mass to maintain a language, a tool set, an environment across platforms and maintain it going forward. And eventually we got passed by developments in things like OpenCL and so on that were perhaps didn't provide some of the benefits, but they were advancing so much faster because there was much bigger critical mass of industry involvement with it.
Sure. Okay, we'll have to end it there. Let's all thank our panelists. Yep.